going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thank you so much, Capital. This is the Going Deep podcast. And in a way, we're going deep on all things NCAA, at least from different angles. You'll understand what I mean in a bit. We're first going to talk to an author of a new book called Hot Dog Money, the FBI informant who exposed the biggest scandal in NCAA history. Now, this book is brought to you by Guy Lawson. You know the name, surely, from War Dogs, another book that he authored that ended up becoming a feature film starring Jonah Hill and Miles Teller. I think this book that we're going to talk to him about today will become a feature film or a docuseries or a podcast series or all of the above. The story is about FBI informant Marty Blaser. And Marty Blaser revealed the business of amateur sport. And now it's not just a philanthropic endeavor like the NCAA wants you to believe. He uncovered the hypocrisy of this system, how people were profiting hugely off of student athletes, and how multiple levels of people in this Ponzi scheme, if you will, were bribed and exploited, all with the end goal of making money off the back of student athletes who, in many cases, had no idea what was going on. Now, there were convictions made possible by Blaser's testimony, which rocked the NCAA at the time, and you could make an argument were influential in the establishment of the NIL, name, image, and likeness rules that we've talked about on this podcast for quite some time, but the winds are changing, and who knows how long those rules will be in place now that it's been ruled that institutions and conferences will have to pay student athletes directly. We'll get into that more later in the episode. But I want to talk to Guy, who was born in Toronto, spent some time in Regina, now lives in New York, about what he learned about the NCAA using his experience and career as a journalist, the places here in Canada like CBC, and if at all the NCAA is salvageable. Well, let's ask Key and find out. We're going deep on all things NCAA based off of the book Hot Dog Money, the FBI informant who exposed the biggest scandal in NCAA history. So I'm really intrigued about this story, how you came across it, and how you decided to tell it this way, because for all storytellers, no matter the medium, once they find a real good story, me and my wife call it a producer fist pump moment, where you just need to get it on paper or on film and get it to the world before someone else does. Finding the story for you, coming across it, and then deciding that you're going to tell it. What was that process like?
Well, you know, it's weird because Marty Blaser came to me, and that doesn't happen very often. And I think I can tell why in hindsight. Marty did not want a sports guy to write the book or a sports person. He wanted someone who understands systemic corruption and crime and the legal system and the complexities of that. And I've written about those subjects extensively through my career. So I wasn't initially at first, I just didn't really get it. But Marty's enthusiasm was so, insistent. So I was working on a different project. And so I said, Marty, just hang on for a minute. The moment it really hit was he was sending me these diaries, and the diaries were just all over the place, bad case of OCD. So, you know, he just couldn't keep a chronological order in anything. So at one point I finally said, look, Marty, if I'm going to do this, you've got to sit down and every day for half an hour and write me an email about something that happened, and you got to keep it in chronological order. And if you do that, if you stick with it, and I've done this with other people before, you will learn a lot about yourself and your story, and I'll figure out whether I can tell a story. And to Marty's great credit, he did that. And as you might know, I mean, he passed away just before the book got published. And right before he died, at 53 years old of a heart attack, right before he died, I had a chance, we finished the book. The book was going to the printer. And I said, did that happen for you, Marty? Did you learn a lot about yourself? Did you have some breakthroughs in that way? And he said he did. So I think for me, the fist pump part of it was really a slow burn, but it definitely was this, I think, you know what, you wanna know what the actual moment is? When Marty started talking smack about the FBI. Now I've been around the FBI a lot through my career, and I never heard anyone quite take it to the hoop the way Marty did, with the way the FBI kind of screwed up this case. So to me, that was like, okay, this guy's really throwing down here. He's willing to burn bridges. And that's when you know you're telling a good story, when you're burning some bridges.
It sounded like it was therapeutic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't set out to be therapeutic for people. I'm not a therapist. I don't have a degree in psychology or anything like that. But it was, I think the telling stories can be a growing and learning experience.
We now know why Marty chose you to tell the story, but why do you think he chose to tell the story full stop?
Well, I mean, I think there's a bunch of ways to think about that. I think there is a fairly common thing for people who go through the criminal justice system to feel like they're kind of in their own movie a little bit. And Marty had some of that feeling to it. Like, and also a lot of people around him were saying, yeah, that's an incredible story. He was chased by a lot of people, a lot of other journalists, sports journalists, and I believe even Michael Lewis at one point was chasing Marty, but he was very insistent on choosing the writer that he wanted to work with. And that, interestingly enough, was me. As I say, I think because of my background in writing about crime and criminals and corruption, but also I think, as in my prior book, a book I wrote before this called War Dogs, which became the movie War Dogs, I have a history of being able to write about pretty people who've done some pretty despicable seeming things in a fair-minded way. And I'm not sure that's a super common trait. Marty was portrayed universally in the press at the time that the case first broke as kind of this scummy guy who was only out for himself. And of course, the truth was much more complicated and interesting.
You mentioned War Dogs and the success, certainly, of it. And I wonder, you know, post that success, when you look at projects, if it's hard not to be tempted to think, okay, is this a book, or could this book also be a movie or episodic podcast? When you see this story, I see so many different life forms of it. But for you, when you were crafting the project, can your focus just be on the written word?
Well, you know, I started out this project, I committed to Marty that I would do a magazine article. And so I started reporting and writing a magazine article, and it got to like 25,000 words, and I was like a third of it in. So I'm like, this is obviously not a magazine article. That was one point of transition. I don't like the movie rights for this book, for Hot Dog Money, have been purchased by George Clooney's outfit, Smokehouse Pictures. But I didn't set out to try to tailor this to Smokehouse. I think it's kind of the other way around, that that in finding stories, the way that they naturally come to me maybe has some sort of element of, I like to pride myself on writing fast paced books and stories that move the reader along and have some sort of narrative impulse. And maybe that's got something to do with film as well. That isn't certainly like the motivating thing for me. The motivating thing is, who am I taking on here? What is the moral universe of this? The NCAA is such a morally bankrupt organization. I liken it in the book to organized crime. They're just whacking up college sports the way the mob used to whack up the country into territories. And they basically, all they're doing is serving themselves, serving the sneaker companies, the television networks. They're not doing anything for the kids in particular, except penalizing them when the kids or their family try to get some benefit from this. So there was a moral impulse to this. And then, of course, there was the law enforcement piece, which was a really deep understanding of how the FBI operates, which was very rewarding in itself as well.
We have had stories of FBI informants before. Certainly that story has been told, but the NCAA aspect of this and sports aspect of this makes this story very unique and different. What about the NCAA going through this process did you learn that maybe you didn't have appreciation for beforehand?
Well, speaking to a Canadian audience, I'm Canadian, right? So I have what I refer to as ironic closeness. I've lived in America for quite a long time now, but my point of view is fundamentally Canadian. So it's kind of like having this gorilla live beneath, you know, like in your house. You kind of know everything about it, but you're not quite of it. So I didn't go to college in America. I don't have a particular team that I cheer for in football or basketball or any sport, really. So I kind of had no, I guess you could say, you know, no bones to pick here. But I guess I just was, I mean, I had a generalized sense, I think shared by probably just about everybody, that the NCAA is kind of like this sketchy outfit that just exploits kids and gets free labor. And that system's going to be, you know, not survive in the long term. But I didn't know just how imperiled it really is and how morally bankrupt it really is. I'll give you an example. So the Supreme Court, this case, when it first broke in 2018 got a lot of attention. And part of it was because Marty was undercover for the FBI offering bribe money to college basketball coaches to, in return, these coaches would conspire to convince their star players to sign on with Marty's financial advisory company. And Marty and the FBI undercovers were basically presenting themselves as organized crime adjacent financial advisors. In other words, just really sleazy guys. And the percentage of coaches who accepted these bribes to manipulate and traffic their own kids was 100%. Every single coach offered money took the money. That was shocking to me. You'd think there'd be one guy who would say, a couple of guys who would say, hey, hang on, I'm talking to this mobster dude in some $5,000 a night suite in Las Vegas, and I'm taking $10,000 in cash. Maybe this is not the best idea, but not one of them said no to that. So that was shocking to me. But then when you compound that with the Supreme Court decision in a case called Alston, where basically the Supreme Court signaled that the next time they get an antitrust case aimed at the NCAA, they're gonna overturn the NCAA's amateur system. And in desperation, the NCAA since then has been trying to figure out how to stave off these antitrust cases. So they've created this name, image, likeness program, but they've refused to do anything to protect the kids. So as I say in the book, all the corruption and sleaziness that surrounds agents and financial advisors is also going to creep into this NIL stuff. And the NCAA is doing nothing to protect these teenagers. That's one element of it. But then you have this new recent, in the last couple of weeks, attempt to introduce a payment scheme by offering $2.8 billion as a settlement. Now, let me ask you this, Donovan. If your opening bid is $2.8 billion, where do you think you're going to land? Like $28 billion? $280 billion? So it seems to me that they're just trying to play out the last few years of this until a whole new system comes into place. And I hope Hot Dog Money can be a contributor to that end, because I really do think that in the interests of kids, the system needs to be reformed and focused on benefiting and protecting the kids, not just preying upon them and exploiting them.
You mentioned, you know, the fact that you are Canadian, and that's the lens that you look at some of this stuff through. I was a student athlete. It started in the NCAA and then transferred back to Canada, and you know, at times we have an inferiority complex as Canadians, and we're desirous for our university sports to look like the NCAA. And I always thought to myself, well, be careful what you wish for. There are certainly trade-offs in that scenario. Is there a happy medium, given the work that you've done on this book and the conversations that you've had, to the mob mentality that you speak of?
I'll give you an example, Donovan, from my personal life. So as I say, I'm Canadian. I have twin daughters who just graduated high school a couple of years ago and had to figure out where to go to school. And so we went through the whole application process, or they did, I should say, in America. And I really asked them to just at least think about Canadian schools. And they did. And they both got accepted into, one of them's going to McGill, the other's at Queen's University. So they both opted out of the American system. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. But I think the biggest thing that I can point to is, in Canada, you're a student, you're not a customer. You're not paying a giant amount of tuition. It's actually like a government, basically a government funded service. And I think that's reflected in the sporting culture as well. So that lots of these schools, you know, recruit these kids through underhanded ways in order to facilitate their recruitment of full paying students, because these kids want to go to these big stadiums and cheer for these teams and have lifelong passions for these sports, which is fine, but I don't know what the hell it has to do with education, because it's just like having a semi-pro league. So it just seems like a very, very mixed message to send to both the student athletes and the student body more generally, to have this like giant industry operating inside the campus with essentially no regulation, all these television revenues just sloshing around. If you go to an American, one of these leading schools, they'll have gyms worth tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and all kinds of like fancy things that I know, for example, at my kids up in Canada, they were a little, you know, their friends are going to American schools where they've got like valet services on your first day moving into dorm. And there's just nothing like that in Canada. I'm biased, obviously, and I'm happy to admit to my bias, but I think that this sports industrial complex thing really is like an element of a broader problem about education in the United States and priorities. So is there a happy medium? I'm not sure that there is, but do I have a preference? I think the Canadians have got a much better sense of proportion and an understanding of the value of what's important in education.
I remember when I started as a journalist doing some stories on NCAA athletes and going to campuses in the United States, and I'd walk out of the athletic facility where there's student athletes parked for the basketball team and the football team, and there's a Range Rover and there's a Rolls Royce. And I said to myself, how are we suspending disbelief? Like,
It's like this fairy dust is dropped all over college sports. Everyone knows this is going on, right? It's like some collective delusion.
Why, given your reporting, do you think that is? Do you think people didn't want to know? They didn't care? They wanted plausible
deniability? I think it's a combination of things. I think that the first and probably foremost thing to think about is who's benefiting and how are they benefiting. And in this case, people like Marty Blaser, who was a financial advisor, the agents around the sneaker companies, the television networks, everyone's making bank. Like, it's works for the stakeholders, the people who doesn't work for the kids. And I think that you can probably agree with me, the kids don't necessarily have the best long-term perspective on their own lives. And you know, the vast majority of those kids that they're, you know, on campuses playing Division I sports are not going to go pro, or if they do, they'll be at the margins. It's the very few that actually go in to make significant money. NIL's changing some of that dynamic. Perhaps a little, kids can make some money out of their college experience, but by and large, that's going to be the peak time for them. So I think, you know, in this book, one of the things that really, I think this is, for my money, this is the most convincing exploration and explanation of how NCAA corruption really works. And Marty takes the reader inside, like the language of corruption, how they don't talk about things on the phone, how they all know what they're doing is dirty, but they don't think it's illegal somehow, how they justify themselves and sort of like give themselves moral permission to exploit these kids. And they even turn it into a virtue, right? Like the NCAA has this self-image as being such a virtue signaling that, you know, they won't let their kids take money. We don't have employees because this is a higher purpose. Well, it's not a higher purpose when you're raking in billions of dollars and divvying it up amongst these adults. You know, virtually every major Division I college coach in the country is the highest paid employee of that state. You know, you got guys making $6, $7, $8, $10, $12 million. There's a guy, Danny Hurley, just turned down $7 million a year to coach the Lakers in the NBA to stay at Connecticut. So, you know, that's portrayed in this sort of delusional press as him being like committed to the program and a real sort of a guy that loves the NCAA. Well, do you think he's not making the same amount of money at Connecticut one way or another? Like, of course he is. So there's just these vast swaths of money sloshing around. And, you know, it's kind of like when you get up on top of it and you start to understand the language and the pervasiveness of the sort of corruption, it's really hard to sort of see this as anything other than predation.
Talked about this being an expose of how NCAA corruption works. Is that works present tense or worked past tense, given from present when you started tense. Writing to now?
Yeah, I mean, things have changed, they haven't changed fundamentally. I mean, they changed at the margins. But, you know, like the thing that this, one of the things that this book does, I think illustrates very well, is how many conversations are happening without the kids or their parents knowing what's going on. Coach talking to the financial advisor, the sneaker company. There's one sneaker company executive from Adidas who comes up with this idea of basically having the coach, the financial advisor, and the sneaker company all self-reinforcing, convince the kid to just deal with them, the kid not knowing that all this is happening behind their back and that his money's being divided up amongst these people. So they, Marty called it a money bubble. And so you could literally have a guy like LeBron James or Zion Williamson never even really understanding what's going on behind their backs and their own finances and their own advice givers. Marty explains how you can make millions of dollars from just one kid. Marty controlled their cars, their houses, their life insurance, their investment strategy, their travel on private jets, their watches, their alcohol, their admission to nightclubs and strip clubs. He basically had 365 control of their lives. And that is like a perilous position for anybody making swaths of money to be in.
So what's the main learning and takeaway from this book? I don't expect the FBI to go around and round up athletic directors and coaches and sneaker executives necessarily. It's not a political issue that I expect to move people at the ballot box this fall. What can we learn from this book and apply to maybe have some semblance of balance?
Well, I think you're right. I don't think that this is going to be and I think it's a win, the NCAA really gets nailed, it's going to be by the courts, because they've been hiding behind this antitrust exemption that gives them this sort of secret power, not secret power, but this power to operate the way no other business on earth does, which is they don't have to pay their labor force. And as one of the Supreme Court justices said, like, you can't not pay podcast hosts because people like to listen to podcasts done by amateurs. It's just ridiculous. So for me, one of the things that I think would be an important and significant change would be to have the NCAA institute a financial literacy courses as part of every student athlete's first semester at college, where they'd have to learn how the system works. Maybe read stories like Hot Dog Money, or have former professionals who've blown through their money come in and talk to them about the perils that they face. So in other words, to begin by addressing how to protect the kids, to create a system with the name, image, likeness, where anybody who wants to do business, these booster clubs with kids, has to be registered with the NCAA, has to submit to ethical and legal oversight. And so that there's transparency. And so the kids and their families can see exactly what's going on, how they're benefiting, and who's getting what from them. So it's that kind of, it sounds marginal, but it's so fundamental it's almost like having no rules of the road for the college sports. So there's no speed limit, there's no stop signs, there's no lane designation. Now, sure, people still get injured driving their car, but it's a lot better when there's a system in place to protect not just the driver, but the people on the street and other people in other cars?
Oftentimes when there is storytelling about the FBI, you know, they come out and say that the characters are not actually accurate and that it was dramatized. What has the response been by the FBI on this story?
Well, in journalism, I've been denounced by the head of the FBI before for a prior story. So I know what that feels like. To me, their silence speaks volumes. There's been nothing. I mean, it's also true of the NCAA. I think that they probably just wanted to go away because this, in the end, this case, while they touted it as being this giant breakthrough, they really were on the verge of what could have been a giant breakthrough. But they, hard to say it any other way, they screwed it up. They got impatient. And then a couple of the agents attached to the case stepped out of line from an ethical and legal point of view, and it just brought it all kind of crashing down. And that was part of what motivated Marty to want to tell his story, was to make sure that the truth came out and that the FBI couldn't sort of hide behind this narrative of great competence and success, because it was, again, a much more complicated story. So, you know, they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. I guess silence is probably like the most sincere form of flattery for journalism, when they just won't say it yet. They have not said a word, and I'm not sure they will.
Unfortunately, Marty is not here to be doing press about the book, but beautifully, his legacy lives on throughout this work. What do you hope people take away from him and his story, given he graciously gave it to you?
Yeah, well, I was grateful for the for him trusting me with the story. You know, I think that Marty, it was, you know, therapeutic, cathartic, however you want to say. To me, it's not a coincidence that he saw this through to the end, and then whatever ailment he had inside his health condition. I mean, he'd had stents put in his heart, but it was a shocker. I mean, it just an absolute, there was no hint that there was anything, that a heart attack was lurking. So, you know, I don't know what, it is a pity that Marty's not here. He was really looking forward to engaging with the FBI and the NCAA and doing podcasts and things like that. But I think my main takeaway from this is that this is another sort of, you know, step along the way to getting real accountability for the NCAA and getting real reform for college sports and getting a system that protects the kids. Because I know that's what Marty's main motivation was. He, as someone who for more than a decade exploited and manipulated the system and knew the language and the secret codes and the mobster handshakes and all that stuff, that was why he was able to go so far for the FBI, because he was fluent in the language of corruption. And I know that Marty felt like that this was an opportunity. And I'll give you a great example of that. At the end of the trials and the convictions, there was 10 convictions in the case, and Marty testified for days. The NCAA approached the federal government and said they wanted Marty to come and talk to them. And Marty thought, okay, I'll go and tell you, because most of what's in the book, Hot Dog Money, is not in the public record because it was not entered in trials. It's never been reported. And Marty never spoke to anyone. Well, this is the first time he's ever spoken out. So he went to see the NCAA in a hotel in Pittsburgh. They sent like a dozen or so investigators and regulators to meet with Marty. And he spent the whole day, like 7 or 8 hours, describing in detail all these conspiracies involving schools like South Carolina, LSU, Arizona, stuff that had not really been reported in the press, and then certainly the details and the nitty-gritty of it hadn't been. And at the end of the day, you know, Marty's been talking for 7 hours straight, and they've been really regulating who could ask questions and making sure it was all kept sort of within bounds. And at the end, Marty says, I can be your catch me if you can. I can be the guy who teaches you how the system really works. I don't want anything from you. I'm not going to be in this business ever again, and I can really explain it to you. So do you have any questions? So this is the head honchos of the NCAA. They look around, silence, and they say, no, well, we have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Blazer. I think you've covered it all. And that sort of speaks volumes to it, right? They, It's not that they don't know. They don't want to know. It's willful lack of knowledge. Because if you tell them, then they got to do something about it. If they got to do something about it, then they got to think through, well, what are we actually doing and why are we doing it? So to me, that was Marty's main motivation, I think, in telling the story. And it came to be mine, too. I think that this entertainment system that was called college sports needs to really take a deep, hard look at itself in the mirror.
Well, you're fluent in the language of educational, entertaining, empathetic storytelling. You've got another one here with this project. Looking forward to seeing the conversation it starts, and looking forward to catching up with you hopefully again when it has another life, when it becomes a weekend box office hit or a streamer docuseries. So thank you for the time.
Thanks, Donovan. Appreciate it. Pleasure to meet you.
Thanks so much to Guy Lawson. You can find him online at Guy Lawson 2 is his handle on X. Or you want to know what he's up to, just go to his website, GuyLawson.com, GuyLawson.com, and find the book, Hot Dog Money, wherever books are sold. The paperback here in Canada is a very affordable $24.99. It is a really good, fast, entertaining read. Similar to War Dogs, you will not be disappointed. Well, we talked about the landmark settling of the dispute between essentially the NCAA and the United States government. We'll get into that after the break, so don't go anywhere.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And as I mentioned earlier, we're doing all things NCAA and finance in this episode. And as you now know, I'm sure, you have heard at this point, the NCAA and the Power Five conferences reached a historic agreement to essentially end the longstanding exploitative tradition of amateurism in college sports, if that's even possible. So now athletes are allowed to receive direct payments from their schools. The settlement includes a $2.7 billion, with a B, distribution to past athletes and future revenue sharing model for current athletes that we're not exactly sure what it might look like. This could mean the athletes are huge winners, but they didn't really have a seat at the table to negotiate this. They don't really have a PA or a union. So are they just being exploited in a different way, but the margins are a bit different and they're sprinkling a little bit of PR? Well, there's no better person to ask about this than Danny Cortonrade, who is hopefully going to become a frequent guest on the podcast. We spoke to him a couple weeks back about the huge opportunities for investment in sport. Go through the podcast feed and listen to that one. If you missed it, it is very good. Well, this to me is a huge area for potential investment in sport. The NCAA, there's proof of concept in the interest, and now you need an infusion of cash. What will that look like? Danny can put it in perspective for us. He's done great work writing for places like, I don't know, Forbes, Yahoo Finance, Sport Business Journal, and he's been so gracious to spend some time with us to talk about the known and potential unknown complications and implications of the NCAA and Power Five conferences now paying their student athletes. Let's go deep with Danny. So Danny, so much going on in the sports world that fascinates me on two levels. One, for the precedent that it's setting, but also for the butterfly effect it could create in the sports world and the business world as we know it now. One of them is, as I'm sure you saw not too long ago, the NCAA and the Power Five conferences reaching a historic agreement about the really essentially amateurism in relation to college sports, what that looks like. And now athletes are going to be getting direct payments from schools after the NCAA and schools tried to hold the line for so long, saying that athletes had to be student athletes first and not employees of the institution. The settlement includes $2.75 billion to distribute across the athletes and a revenue sharing model moving forward. When you heard this landmark ruling, what came to mind in terms of the impact this could have and the potential space for investment?
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. And first of all, thanks for having me. This is huge, right? This is a big thing, what happened recently. We started with the NIL, right, in 2021, but this what's now happening, and you mentioned it, the $2.75 billion going to those athletes. I think a couple of things here. So in the old model, the under the traditional amateurs model, their college athletes were prohibited from receiving any form of payment, right? So this model was based on the principle that athletes were students first and foremost, and participating in sports as in, yeah, that was something, an addition almost. With the new model, this agreement allows athletes to receive direct payments, right, from the colleges and universities. And that will be up to $20 million per school annually. So this will distribute it directly to those athletes. And I think this, from my perspective, this is a great thing. Those athletes and students already putting so much time and effort in also playing on the highest level, but they didn't earn any money from it. So I think this is just a great thing. I believe in focus, right? Also with building ventures, over investing, focused on the things that you want to do and not try to do everything at the same time. So if they already can earn money, they don't have to stress to get extra money in. And so for me, this is a great thing that's happening. So if you look at the revenue sharing, in the old model, the revenues from college sports, particularly from those TV contracts and sponsorship deals, they were all going into institutions. Now with the new model, again, it goes also directly to these athletes. If you look at the NIL, the old model, to the prior recent changes, the athletes will not to allow to get any profit from their own name, image, and likenesses. And now with the new model, this is all possible. And I think that's also a great thing to build their own brand and build on top of that. Also, not only on the field, but also off the field. So again, from my perspective, this is an historic moment and agreement between the NCAA and the Power Five. And will make a significant disruption in the traditional model in college sports.
So obviously you need to raise the capital to pay these players, and the school certainly may not want to cut into their existing margin, which opens up the door for private equity to be involved, which, you know, to raise, you know, capital at scale is obviously good, but sometimes private equity becomes involved in it. Doesn't necessarily make things better. Just ask Red Lobster. In terms of what this might mean for NCAA athletic programs, many of which the athletic departments didn't necessarily run at a profit. They raised a lot of money, but they also spent a lot of money. How will this change potentially the way we see our college sports run?
Yeah, look, a couple of things. So there's a lot of things happening. Private equity, yeah, that can be positive for the clubs and the leagues and also this college sports. There are also some challenges coming to that, right? Because you're involving all kind of people. From my perspective, it needs to be the perfect fit. So there needs to be strategic value and people who already have done this before and have the experience. Then it definitely can help the clubs and the colleges. They can be, from a business strategy point, they can be strategic advisors. They can help with operational improvements. So to bring the expertise and optimizing operations, that can lead to cost savings and increased profitability. The network access, right, the industry connections that private equity firms can bring to the table. Partnerships, opportunities, and thinking potentially also, okay, how can we create value here and long-term planning and maybe also for those players or specific things. Access strategy normally in this PE industry. And I think in the end, financial stability. So if you have the capital infusion from those PE firms, that can stabilize the finance for the sports teams. And in the end, also will help with the debt reduction. And in the end, I also look at that as a business, right? So there needs to be professional management. I don't say it's not there yet, but I think there's always room for improvement. And that's also something where the PE industry can help with. And then in the end, increase the team valuations and the player valuations. There's a big opportunity. And I think not to forget is in the end, how can we also make sure there will be a greater equality in college athletes? So what I mean with that is to have the same. We spoke about it a couple of weeks before, Donovan, right? With women and men's sports, I think there's now a big opportunity also for women's sports from that perspective, that with the Title IX compliance, there will be gender equity in all those educational programs, including athletics. And that's a big thing. I think there we can now focus on to get that on the same level. At the same time, there is a revenue disparity. So you have high and low revenue sports. So football and men basketball generates the most revenue. And then you have the lower revenue sports like rowing or tennis. Soccer is growing, but it's still not there yet. And that can be challenging for the school. So they need to be sure, okay, how can we manage that? That are my two cents.
Yeah, the Title IX implications to me are somewhat intriguing and fascinating, because how do you legislate for equity in a free market, capitalistic sort of competitive scenario? And even if you did have equity, you say, well, we want to invest in Katie Ledecky as a swimmer because she's going to the Olympics, but not necessarily the backup goalie for, the women's lacrosse team. Do you have any idea how, given the different levels of investment across the NCAA, how you could come up with a standard that would make sense?
Just to understand exactly what you're meaning here, I just want to that I answer this question in the right way. So
yeah. Do you have any idea how they could legislate equity when the value of different athletes across genders, to the university is vastly different?
Yeah. There is still that. How can we tackle this, and how will we get greater equality in this college athletes athletics? So the first important thing is the Title IX compliance, right? So the legal requirements. So the Title IX mandates gender equity in this educational programs. That's a thing, but we're not there yet. We're all looking, okay, what does this mean exactly? And schools will need to balance payments between those male and female athletes. So, which may not straightforward given the direct revenue generating potential of those different sports, right? Or what I was talking about, because you have those high and low revenue sports. So it's not that easy just to say, okay, it will be exactly the same, because you have different kind of viewership and just people who are coming to the game. So how are we making sure you manage this in the best possible way? And then you have the wealthy and the less wealthy schools. So I think there's also a big thing, right? So schools with a larger athletic budget, particularly those in the Power Five conferences, will have a big advantage in compensating those athletes. And potentially there will be a gap between the less wealthy schools. So that there's a thing what we need. And then, the recruitment dynamics, right? So those higher compensation could influence the recruitment dynamics for the top athletes. So there's an interesting thing still happening. We need to see how it will work out. Again, this is a great thing, but a lot of things we need to do research on and to see, okay, what will exactly happen now in the next coming months and next year when we officially launch it.
You mentioned in terms of private equity, it has to be the perfect fit. I look at this and I think, is the perfect fit not brands to own some of these programs? If, you know, Phil Knight is the president of all Oregon athletics, if Kevin Plank is the president of all Maryland athletics, and the brands having similar incentives and goals as the athletic programs own and run teams in a way a pro owner would. Could you see some fits there, the way the brand started to dabble in the NIL game?
Yeah, it needs to be the perfect fit, like you're saying. We are very, very careful where we're putting our money, right? We're doing a lot of due diligence, looking into all kind of factors. If you look at a company still, right, what's the market size, how much, what's the business model, what's the team behind it, how scalable is it, all the financials. And it's also the same with these kind of things, when, okay, what do we have here? But the brand is definitely a big part of it, right? We saw that in different men leagues and clubs, but now also what we were talking about with Caitlin Clark, her brand, how valuable that is for the WNBA. The same for those NIL younger players in the top there. There's so much potential, so athletes can develop important skills in brand management, marketing, public relationships, and that will help them in the future, and but also for the colleges to leverage their brand and build on top of that. That's something what I'm doing already for many, many years, working with brands like Nike and Adidas and FC Barcelona, Real Madrid, but also here the Lakers. There's so much value in that. So yes, I think for those colleges, there is a big opportunity right now to leverage that and to build that in the best possible way. But again, you need to have the right expertise and the right people involved to make that happen.
When I think of this from the student athlete perspective, I think of hopefully the need to address financial literacy, something that's not talked about to the entire student body, never mind these walking brands that are student athletes, given the direct payments that are coming to them soon, what should financial education look like for these student athletes?
Very, very important this, right? Because there's money coming in. They are still young, don't have the financial knowledge, a lot of them probably. Maybe some of them they have through family or parents, but in a lot of cases, there's still a lot of work to do. And that's crucial, right? Because if you do this in the right way from that moment, it has so much advantage for you for the rest of your career. And yeah, it will have immediate financial benefits if you are able to build a financial stability for yourself, because there's money coming in, and sometimes also still what is serious money. So I think there is a big opportunity for the financial institutions and also, yeah, groups like ourselves, where we working with bigger banks like JP Morgan to help those athletes and to build to help with wealth management. Yeah, so I think there are the educational programs. So many universities may offer financial literacy programs as part of their support for the athletes. But I think there we need to be very on top of things and helping them in a great way, right? And support their and help with financial advisors, planning resources, where they will have, yeah, a big advantage for the rest of their career.
You mentioned Caitlin Clark and the Caitlin Clark effect. Recently, she was left off the USA Olympic team, and my first thought was, I mean, it's arguable whether or not she could make it. They're going to win regardless of her being on the team or not. But my first thought was that was a terrible business decision for Nike, for USA Basketball, for the Olympics, for the host city in Paris, for NBC, certainly, the broadcaster of the games. But this is just my feeling. I don't really have any tangible proof to back that up, other than the fact that, you know, the top four TV audiences ever for the WNBA have been her games. You study these types of things. When you start to think about the tangible financial impact of the Caitlin Clark effect, where do you look? Where would the trend lines be shown?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, well, this was a I wouldn't make the same decision here because there's so much momentum going on with her and our brand and all the things that she's able to achieve. So from a financial impact, I would say, look, this is a big opportunity for USA Basketball to have her included in that. So many people are following, because if you also look, the younger generation, a lot of times, are not following the clubs or the leagues. They're following the athletes, right? That's what you see, what's happening. So Caitlin Clark is a perfect example. People would definitely follow her and the impact that she was creating and the brand deals that we could make and build on top of that. I believe, from that perspective, you definitely want to have her in that team. At all kind of other decisions why it did not happen. But from a financial point of view, we missed definitely an opportunity here.
Yeah, there's recently a story in the Washington Post about the WNBA and the fact that it's, you know, on pace to lose $50 million this year. Now, I don't know how much you can take that number with a grain of salt, because as you know, you can do accounting in many different ways to show gains or losses or whatnot. But a league almost 30 years now, in any investment, you expect to be getting, I'd assume, return back sooner than three decades, even though in starting something new, you generally are going to lose money to start. When you look at the fact that you're very bullish on women's sports as an investment, how do you see that sort of reporting, and what is an acceptable burn rate for women's sports where the investment will still make sense, you know, if you're playing the long game, hoping to cash in later?
Yeah, for us, it's normally 10 years, right? It's a decade where we're looking at with our funds. We are still bullish on women's sports, that's for sure. We spoke about it last time with the NWSL, the WNBA, where we have close contact, where we're speaking with both leagues, with franchises, and there's a lot of things coming up. So with the WNBA, right, they're looking into 10, 12 cities right now, Miami, Chicago, and a lot of other cities. But it's about the demographics, the fan engagement in the cities, and all kind of different other things. And they're looking for investors. They are committed on the long term, right? This is a long term game, because yes, there is a lot of things going on, and yes, people are talking about it and going to the games. But we will get some hurdles, right? Nothing is easy in life. So there's still a lot of things that we need to do to get that on the level where we're all looking for. We definitely have momentum. But again, also these leagues are looking for strategic investors who are willing to commit long term. So if you look at the Angel F City here in LA, valuation is now right now $185 million. San Diego team, $120 on the top of my head. Portland Thorns was with the family that came in a couple months ago at a $63 million valuation. So if you look where we started and where we are right now, all positive. But yeah, there are definitely, again, there will be hurdles. So there's still a lot of things to do. But there's a chicken egg story. The viewership is going up in a significant way since 2019, 500% for the NWSL. So yes, if there's more attention, more money is coming in, more corporate sponsors are willing to pay. And that's all good. That are all great things. And that keeps us bullish. And the multiple revenues that's coming in, the corporate sponsorship, there's a scarcity effect. So we still believe, again, not every opportunity will be a great opportunity, but there definitely will be winners in this game.
When you look at it, WNBA expansion, I thought the last two decisions to me were a no-brainer. The Bay Area success on the NBA side, they've unlocked the Far East in terms of sponsorship deals with the Warriors. That group hopefully could do the same. And then with the Toronto franchise, you get to sell to an entire country, new media rights package, international. That makes a lot of sense. The next wave of expansion, a little bit more intricate in terms of the finite details on how you make sense. You mentioned lots of things in terms of market, in terms of the right investor. You know, Miami might be intriguing because of those reasons, and potentially Serena Williams. If Kathy Engelbert gave you a call and said, Danny, we're going two by two, like Noah's Ark. My next two franchises should be where. You would say where and why?
Yeah, I think a couple things here. Miami is something where we're now looking at, so that could be an interesting region. We're in the middle of the diligence, so doing all our homework. So I want to be careful what I'm mentioning here. But again, it's for us, it's important. Where are we located? And can we get the people there? And can we monetize the tickets, the younger fans, the online presence, and a lot of other things? So the demographics are crucial for us. But yeah, we have a couple bigger cities in mind where we think it makes sense. And yeah, we cannot share too much about it, but we're researching 10, 12 cities right now. And yeah, a lot of groups are interested, but again, it needs to be the strategic partner, and they are committed for the long term.
Love to hear it. Hope to stay posted. My last question to you is about a new basketball venture that has been announced, Unrivaled, a women's 3x3 league. Six teams of five players planning to play January, February, March. I love more opportunities for women to make money in sport, but I don't really see the pathway to success here. You're going up against, you know, a very stacked sports schedule at that time of year. There's no built-in, you know, institutional understanding around rivalries or why these games matter outside of, you know, top women playing, but we can see them already. This sounds like, to me, live golf. You may have great players, but if there are no stakes and storylines, it's tough for me to find interest and audience around it. When you look at this venture, what am I missing? Where's the opportunity in this Unrivaled Women's 3x3 league?
Yeah, we also looking at it. It's for me, I'm also still not there. It can be interesting. I also saw a lot of people jumping on the opportunity. I know quite some investors who, yeah, now committed to it. But yeah, from our thesis with our funds, we're looking more into the women's sports, what we discussed, and WSL, the WNBA. That's something that we prefer and where we feel comfortable in. There's definitely some momentum going on, right, with the 3x3. It's the largest urban team sport in the world. So there's the FIBA is behind it, and there's definitely some interesting things going on. But yeah. Let's see where it goes. We're looking at everything, and the team and the investments analysts looking at different kind of opportunities. But for now, we're leaning into those two, what I just mentioned.
Well, when you look at investment in sport, it doesn't necessarily have to be leagues or, you know, specific sports. It could be in technology. And since last we spoke, I feel like there's been a bunch of announcements around AI technology, most notably Apple. When there's the interest in you know, technology, then funds often follow. What are you seeing in terms of the ability to get into the sports ecosystem via the explosion of AI?
Look, we love the sports technology space. That's something what definitely excites us. We touched on it last time. So the sports market is $500 billion. We'll go to $625 billion. The sports technology market, 2021 was $13 billion, 2022 $30 billion. We will go to $40-$50 billion, and in 2030 it will be $103 billion. And 43% is going into fan engagement, and AI is also a big part of it. So yes, it's definitely excites us. It was actually last week I was at Google HQ here in Los Angeles, also a workshop about AI and how it will influence our life and how big it is, and how these top companies worldwide are tapping into this space. So we cannot ignore it. We don't want to follow the hype. We're still critical on it. But for us as an investment firm, we look at that as a total ecosystem. So we will invest in clubs and leagues. We will invest in sports technology, that is fan engagement and AI, and a big data play. So this will all work together as one big ecosystem. And AI is definitely a big part of it. So we're looking at least 15 decks per day, what we get in inbounds, people who are reaching out to us and have all kinds of solutions. there are great solutions, not so great solutions, and the people are just trying to get the word AI in there because they think then we will get some. So it's right. It's they think that then we will get the meeting. That's obvious, not how it works. But yeah, look, in the sports, this is a big game changer for all of us. And we're looking closely at it with the big data and AI solutions, the injury preventions for the athletes, grassroots, but also tier one athletes. This is a game changer. And yeah, we have one opportunity where we're now looking at. Hopefully we can get that off the ground. But very excited and bullish also on that part. Again, not everything will get there. A lot of people are trying now. There will also be a lot of failures of people who are just trying and where we can learn from. Let me put it like that. Maybe not call up failures. But yeah, it's definitely not something that we can ignore.
Well, you do such a good job of cutting through the buzz and the hype and giving us the real reasoning around what opportunities make sense now and in the future. So thank you so much. We'll continue to follow you, read you, and whenever you have time, we'll continue to pester you with questions on where the space is going.
Thank you so much, Donovan. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Danny. Real knowledgeable guy. Love listening to him make really complex things sound pretty straightforward and simple, but it's only that way when you put in the level of years and research and study that he has. A couple ways you can keep up with him and everything he's got going on. He is the founder of In Studio Ventures. You can give them a follow at In Studio Venture on X. His handle on X is at Danny Corten Ray 1. That is DannyCortenRae1. Or just go to his website, DannyCortenRae.com, is where you can read his work and see what he finds interesting in the world of sports, tech, and investment. Hopefully you found this episode interesting and helpful, putting in perspective what NCAA sports will look like moving forward and maybe what some of the ills of the past may have been. Feel free to like, favorite, share, and subscribe. Talk to you soon.